This is Nightmare in Wisconsin.
The trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Accusations of first-degree intentional homicide, strangulation, mutilation, dismemberment, and necrophilia.
We bring you raw, unfiltered courtroom audio from the trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Okay, before we bring the jury out, just briefly, I've had distributed to you a set of instructions and a proposed set of outline as to how they should be given. There's certainly other instructions that could be given that were given to the jury the first time regarding objections of counsel, improper questions, things of that nature. Although they've gotten all those instructions already, I'm not sure the need to do that. But I'm going to start with the state. Mr. Saunders, do you have any feedback regarding the proposed instructions I laid out, alternative suggestions?
No, and I have no additions. I'm fine with the ones the court selected. I guess our one quibble, our preference would be to do the instructions, then closing, but that's the only change the state would have.
Mr. Fralick?
Your Honor, I agree with that. I'd ask that the court give the jury the instructions, and then we could do the closings. When I look at 605B on question one, it talks about at the time the crime was committed, did the defendant have a mental disease or defect? But then in question two, it says, it uses the word mental disease or defect as well. I'm wondering if the court would consider mental disease or mental defect. Because it's either a mental disease or a mental defect.
Sure. I'd certainly consider that. The other thing is, you'll note, and I'll consider the issue that you've mentioned regarding when I give the instructions, and I want to just a brief conversation about that, but we can take that up when evidence is concluded. I gave you 605B. It was actually 605B, the version with the comments, because of the paragraph on the second page of 605D, the comment about the possibility of using the phrasing mental disease and defect, and then it's cited the case. I don't think that's appropriate to use and in this case, given how the evidence comes in. That case that cites phrasing it mental disease and defect apparently was in a situation wherein the assertion was that there was a combination that went into the events. A mental disease and defect were co-occurring, and so counsel asked that the word be changed. I don't think that's what's going on in this case. The evidence seems to come in this case that either there is a mental disease or a mental defect, and there's one or the other, and the jury can look at it and decide. They can choose either one. But it's not a case where we're driving at a specific argument that there's a combination of the two and therefore changing the word to and. Nonetheless, I wanted to call it to your attention. I don't have any problem with your request, Mr. Fralick, to change that question two to as a result of the mental disease or mental defect. Any problem with that, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Any concern with leaving it as an or, Mr. Fralick, versus an and?
I've always thought that it was an or, Your Honor.
And that's the pattern instruction. I only provided that one case note to indicate that there is a situation in which it was changed to and that's permissible. I don't think it's appropriate for how the evidence is coming in this case, but I'm going to leave it as or. You're not asking for anything else. You don't have any objection to or, do you, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Okay. Very good. I'll add that one word in. And then we'll discuss the order of the instructions versus your closings at the conclusion of the evidence, and we'll actually have an official instruction conference at that time. Okay, then anything else before the jury comes in, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Fralick?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
For the jury. Doctor, if you want to step forward.
Okay, be seated. All right. We're back on the record, and we're up for cross-examination. Mr. Frelick, do you have cross-examination?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Dr. Engine, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. So you work for Behavioral Consultants, is that correct?
Yes.
That's in Milwaukee?
Yes.
Is that part of the Wisconsin Forensic Unit?
Wisconsin Forensic Unit is a division of Behavioral Consultants.
Okay. And with regards to this case, you did not do a competency evaluation. You did an NGI evaluation?
Correct.
Okay. You met with Taylor Shabizis, correct?
Yes.
You recognize her here?
I do.
And, ma'am, you met with her at the Brown County Jail on October 12th and October 21st of 2022?
Yes.
Have you met with her since?
No.
So it's been, is it fair to say that it's been about 9 months since you've seen her, correct?
Yes.
The first time that you tried to see her, there was some sort of a security issue going on and you were not allowed to see her, is that correct?
I was allowed to see her, but only cell side, and I thought that would be inappropriate to conduct an interview cell side.
Okay. As far as the things that you did to, you know, put your report together, you relied on the two clinical contacts on October 12th and October 21st of 2022, correct?
Yes.
You administered the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory 3, correct?
Yes.
I see that number changes oftentimes. Has it changed?
I can't recall how long it was the MMPI 2, but it was that edition for several decades, and the MMPI 3 was based on 2017 population estimate. So it's a relatively recent edition.
And it gets updated and upgraded every few years. Is that fair?
No, it was many decades before it was updated.
Okay. And it's essentially a true-false test?
That's the response format. It's more complicated than that.
Okay. What kind of questions are on this MMPI?
So I provided, you know, an example that I made up, but it there's various statements, and the respondent is asked to respond true or false if they agree or mostly agree with the statement or disagree or mostly disagree with the statement.
Strongly disagree?
I can't recall the test instructions, but something to that effect.
Do people that have, you know, education issues or lack of education, do they struggle with the MMPI?
There is a reading level that's required to administer the MMPI. I don't recall it off the top of my head.
How many questions are on the MMPI?
About 335.
Okay. How long does it take to get through the test?
In the case of Ms. Shabizis, I believe it was completed within about 90 minutes, maybe an hour and 45 minutes.
Sometimes longer if you have difficulty reading?
Could be.
So that was done. You reviewed some police reports in this case?
Yes.
A criminal complaint and some video footage, is that fair?
Yes.
Photographs?
Yes.
How did you get that information?
It was provided as part of the entire file. That's standard. It comes along when we receive a referral for an NGI evaluation.
Was it sent to you by the district attorney's office?
My office would have taken care of that. I received it from my office.
Okay. And then you looked up some information on CCAP, the Circuit Court Access Program?
Yes.
Basically a search on the internet of her background?
Correct.
Specifically her prior record?
Yes.
And then you looked at some Brown County Human Services records?
Yes.
Would that be the Nicolet Psychiatric Center records?
Yes.
Okay. So you looked at those?
Yes.
And then you looked at some jail records?
I did not. I requested the jail records, but they had not been received.
And was there a request to see some Purveya health records?
Yes.
Did you get to see those?
No.
Okay. Did you review any Bellin health records?
No.
Was it your understanding that Taylor Shabizis had had some treatment stays at Bellin Health in the past?
Yes, I understood that she attempted suicide at age 14, resulting in the admission to Bellin.
And what about at Purveya? Was it your understanding that she had gone there for some mental health treatment as well?
Yes, outpatient treatment.
Okay. So you were missing the Bellin records and the Purveya records, correct?
Correct.
Now, you got some relevant history, some background information about my client, correct?
Yes.
You found out that she was born in Chicago, correct?
Yes.
She was raised in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Is that fair?
Yes.
And then she moved to Green Bay in 2009 at maybe age 11?
Yes.
And that same year her mother passed away?
Yes.
Was it your understanding that her mother died in the house when she was there?
I don't know those details.
Was it your understanding then that she was raised by her father, Arturo Coronado?
Yes.
Okay. And then did she also relate to you that she moved to Cotulla, Texas when she was 16 to live with her grandparents?
Yes.
And that she had a series of moves. She lived in Cotulla and Alice, Texas, and Jackson, Mississippi?
Yes.
Then came back to Green Bay?
Yes.
That's kind of the progression, is that fair?
Correct.
You found out that she was also married in February of 2020?
Yes.
And when you were involved, had she given birth to her child?
Yes, that was October 2021.
Ultimately, the child went to live with the grandparents, correct?
Yes.
In Texas?
Yes.
Did you garner information that she was in a, an abusive marriage with her husband?
What I gathered was that she was married. There was discord within the marital relationship, which led Ms. Shabizis to rekindle her friendship and romance with the victim in this case, and that would have been in 2020. I can't speculate beyond that, the nature of the relationship.
Did you get any information that her husband was hitting her in the head?
Objection, no. Asked and answered. She doesn't know.
No, that's a different question.
Overruled.
No.
Okay. So you got some background regarding her life, correct?
Yes.
Did you find out that she went to middle school in Green Bay and went to Bayport High School as well?
I don't recall that specific detail. I know that she graduated high school in Texas.
As part of the educational, assessment, as part of your report, did she report a history of some learning disabilities or difficulties?
She did. She attributed them to a diagnosis of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
And was it such that she had some issues with school, suspensions, ultimate expulsion?
Yes, she was expelled the result of fighting.
The information that you have as far as your November 14th, 2022 report, it's somewhat stale. Is that fair?
I would disagree with that.
It is from last year, though, correct?
Correct.
Nobody gave you any reports from Bell and Health to review, correct?
Correct.
You could have, Doctor, upgraded your report by looking at additional records, Bellin, Health, and the Purveyor records. Is that fair?
Where I left my report, as indicated on the last page, is that I would be happy to receive any additional records that I was unable to obtain, and I would update my report once received if it changed my opinion. I received no additional records after submission of this report.
Your colleague in the field is Dr. Matthew Seipel, correct?
Yes.
And did you confer with him with regards to, you know, your opinions, your assessment, your evaluation?
No.
Did you share any information with him?
I did provide him a copy of my records that I obtained from Brown County at his request, and that's a common practice among evaluators.
Sure. But fair to say that he did not send you, he didn't reciprocate by sending you the Bellin Health records that he had?
No, he did not.
Okay. That is something that could have been done, correct?
If I was not alerted that those were part of our practice, I wouldn't have known to request those, and it's not clear to me that Dr. Seipel would know that I was looking for those. Typically, what will happen is that I will receive additional records from one of the court principals with an indication that they would like a second review of the issue.
Does it surprise you that, you know, as far as Dr. Seipel is concerned, I provided the Bellin Health records to him for his evaluation and that he didn't send them to you?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Does it surprise you that, you know, I sent the Bellin Health records to Dr. Seipel and he didn't send them to you?
That would not surprise me because unless he had instruction to provide them to me, that would not be common practice.
You don't share information then, correct?
Only upon request, if it's appropriate, if it would be appropriate and permissible and specifically requested, but we don't, as a general practice, pass records between doctors.
Okay. If you had received these records, you could have done a supplemental report. Is that fair?
If it changed my opinion, if I felt that it was relevant and added meaningfully to this evaluation, I would have, yes.
Now, as it relates to the Nicolet Psychiatric Center, you had a chance to look at all those records, correct?
Yes.
And was it your understanding that Taylor Shabizis was committed and she was sent to that facility for, you know, mental health treatment, correct?
Yes.
And you were aware, tell me if you were you aware of an order for civil commitment for her?
I was not.
Okay. Had you ever been made aware that she was under an order to take psychotropic medications?
No.
If I told you that she was civilly committed in April of 2021, where the court, a court of law, determined that she was mentally ill, would that cause you to have any concerns?
It would certainly be relevant, but it does fit with the information I already had that Ms. Shabizis was discharged from that facility to outpatient treatment with the goal of receiving substance use treatment.
And did you know when she was at the Nicolet Psychiatric Center that she was under an order to take medication?
No.
Did you know that she was required to take antipsychotic medication?
Yes, I was aware that she was prescribed Abilify, an antipsychotic.
Injectable antipsychotic?
Initially oral, later injectable.
Now, during your two contacts with her in October of 2022. Did you get a sense that she was suffering from any kind of auditory or other hallucinations?
She reported that to me, but the her behavioral presentation to me was inconsistent with her self-report. And the quality of her self-report was not consistent with genuine psychosis.
Did you gain any information that she was suffering from a mood disorder when you met with her?
Her emotional expression was odd when I met with her, but I would, she did not present as acutely depressed or hypomanic, let alone manic. So I wasn't seeing significant indication of a major mood disorder.
You did see in the Nicolet records that there's a diagnosis for her of bipolar 1, correct?
Yes.
With psychotic features, is that correct?
I don't recall that qualifier, but certainly the record does indicate that she was experiencing psychotic symptoms at that time.
And that is a qualifiable mental disease or mental defect, correct?
Yes.
Do you agree that if someone has an underlying mental health disorder, that using or abusing drugs can exacerbate that mental health disease or defect or condition?
I would agree with that statement.
Did you notice that Ms. Shabizis was a poor historian when you asked her questions and asked her to expound on whatever topics of discussion?
Where I found that she provided a sufficiently detailed history, where she was lacking was when I asked her to describe her recollection of the underlying offenses.
Did you note her to have memory loss or memory impairment?
I did not. Aside from that self-reported amnesia, I did not detect memory loss.
How much time did you spend with her on October 12th of 2022? Do you know?
I would estimate about 15 minutes.
15?
Yes.
Okay. And then, doctor, on October 21st, 2022, how much time did you spend with her then?
I can't recall. My best estimate would be about 3 hours, but that's 9 months old.
Long time ago, right?
9 months, yes.
Okay. Do you agree that methamphetamine use does cause brain damage?
It does have that potential.
And how about adolescent long-term marijuana use? Same thing?
I'm less certain about that.
Certainly, if you're using heroin or cocaine or drugs like that, that can cause brain damage as well?
Yes.
When you met with her, you did find that she exhibited some psychotic symptoms. Is that fair?
No.
In some of the records that you reviewed through Nicolet, did you recall reading anything about a recommendation for her to be on Haldol?
No. And then to be clear with your last question, I did not personally observe psychotic symptoms during the moments of my evaluation of Ms. Shabizis, but I did see in the record indication of past psychotic symptoms, to be clear.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Did you see in the records there was a recommendation for her to be on Haldol?
No, I don't recall that.
You were asked to opine on the NGI issue, correct?
Yes.
Dr. Seipel was asked to opine on the competency issue, correct?
That is correct.
We're not talking about competency, we're talking about NGI. Is that fair?
Yes.
You had a chance to review Dr. Lighton's report. Is that fair?
Yes.
You read through the entire report, and you're familiar with Dr. Lighton's opinions, correct?
Yes.
And do you agree with her findings?
No.
You would agree that Dr. Lighton's report is more current than yours. Is that fair?
Well, it was authored more recently, but the authoring of the report has little to do with its relevancy, because we were both doing an evaluation that was retrospective. So if you're looking at it, my evaluation would be more current than Dr. Lighton's, because mine was in closer proximity to the alleged offenses. So that's another way to look at it.
But another way to look at it is your, with due respect, your report is lacking because you don't have the, you haven't reviewed the Bell and Health records, correct?
It is missing that piece of information, but I would like to point out that it's not common for me as an evaluator when I'm looking at an offense that occurred in 2022 to be requesting records from when one was a teenager. Those would not be, they're certainly generally relevant, but they say little about what was going on in 2022.
Did Taylor Shabizis tell you that she had no memory of the alleged offense?
Did she tell you?
When did she tell you that on both dates? October 12th and October 21st?
I did not ask her about the offenses on the first date. I only asked her on the second date, which is when she reported the amnesia.
That was on October 21st of 2022?
Yes.
And in reviewing those Nick Lay records, it's true that she was hospitalized, correct?
Yes.
For about a month, right? A couple weeks?
Somewhere between a couple of weeks and a month.
Okay. And that she was prescribed some medication for nightmares?
I believe that she was prescribed Abilify.
And, I can go ahead.
Refresh my recollection.
Page 3.
Thank you. Okay, sure. She did say Prazosin for nightmares.
Okay. And it was such that when you talked with Taylor Shabizis that she was actively hearing voices, those were the comments that she made to you?
Yes.
Did she indicate to you that she was hearing voices in her cell?
Yes.
Who were they of?
I think she was less clear. They were very vague. She may have suggested that she was hearing voices of her coworkers, pejorative in nature. She also said that she was hearing a voice saying, "I love you." I don't know who she said was saying, "I love you."
Can you tell me, can you help me with this? What is a manic symptom?
That would be extreme mood elevation, increased goal-directed activity, decreased need for sleep, decreased risk appraisal. Those are some primary characteristics.
Extreme mood, like throwing a chair at a doctor?
What I gather that you're referring to is the evaluation of Dr. Lighton of
yes.
Ms. Shabizis. I'm hesitant to characterize that as a product of a manic episode.
As far as you understand, it happened out of the blue, correct?
Yes.
Did you have the occasion to review the report from Dr. Tracy Lucetta?
No.
This is a yes or no. You could have gone back to see Ms. Chavizas after October 21st of 2022. Is that correct?
If you're looking for a yes or no answer, I'm not able to answer that in a yes or no fashion.
The fact is you didn't, correct?
That is correct.
Did you see, when you met with her in October, did you see her use odd or unusual facial expressions?
Yes, I believe there were instances of her smiling inappropriately.
It didn't track or it didn't follow, correct? It was out of context, is that fair?
Yes.
Okay, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Redirect, Mr. Saunders.
Doctor, I want to pick up on questions towards the end there. You were asked to describe what a manic episode or manic symptoms are. Is that right?
Yes.
With respect to a bipolar 1 diagnosis, one of the requirements is a manic episode, right?
Yes.
And how long do those typically last?
They can last for quite a long time, and then that would be, based on my experience, that they can last as long as months, oftentimes until treatment is administered.
The diagnostic criteria sort of requires there to be a week of manic episode. Is that fair?
I would need to look at the DSM, but that would make sense.
All right. So you said that you were hesitant to say the instance of chair throwing was a manic episode. Is that what you said?
Yes.
And can you explain why?
There are many reasons for a person to throw a chair. One of them could be due to a manic episode. But before I would make that conclusion, I would want to have compelling evidence that such a diagnosis is appropriate, and that would need to include objective evidence, meaning observation over time when a person is not being thinking that they're being viewed, things of that nature.
Okay. So I guess then would some of that objective evidence be to consider time periods both before and subsequent to the manic episode that you're observing?
Yes.
Why would that be helpful to know?
It would speak to consistency of behavior. There's a lot of information that can be gathered by looking at behavior over time. When is the onset? Does it happen? I mentioned this earlier. Does it happen when people are not being when they do not know that they're being observed, things like that. And then there's more, the more objective evidence there is, the more credible that diagnosis can be.
So I guess in general, if you're attempting to determine whether somebody is actively having a legitimate manic episode, you sort of look at the time frame both before and after.
Yes.
You were asked some questions about your interactions with Ms. Chavizas about her reporting or endorsing that she was hearing voices. You remember those questions?
Yes.
And you indicated sort of her response to those were sort of vague in terms of what she was experiencing.
Correct.
And in your opinion, did that appear to be consistent with genuine psychosis?
No.
Why is that?
To me, my take on them was that they were represented some social anxiety, some rumination, her thinking about her circumstances. They seemed like more of an internal dialogue versus an actual auditory hallucination, which can tend to be more bizarre. You also will see behavioral indication that a person is responding to internal stimuli or the auditory hallucination. So you'll see indication. Maybe the person won't even say that they are experiencing these voices, but they'll be distracted, have a difficult time completing their thoughts. It's a lot more subtle of an expression than simply saying, I'm hearing voices.
And none of the sort of other things you are trained to look for, you observed in Misha Business?
Correct.
And in addition, you've already testified to concerns about exaggerating of symptoms.
Yes.
You were asked questions about review of certain records, particularly the Bell and Health records. You were aware that there was a prior attempt of self-harm previous in Mr. Business's history?
Yes, at age 14.
Okay. And you know, records from that age, 10 years or so from prior to the date of the offense that you're attempting to determine here, do you believe anything in those records would substantially change the opinions you're testifying here to today?
As I know it, there's not anything that would speak specifically to the issue of the NGI plea. But as I indicated, I would have been happy to receive those records if they had been made available to me. I felt, though, that for me, one of the main issues was Misha Business's use of methamphetamine at the time of these offenses. And I don't think that information generated 10 years prior would change that. So in sum, no, I do not believe those records would change my opinion.
Okay. And then I'll sort of pick up on the methamphetamine you brought up because you were asked some questions about that, about psychotic symptoms that you had observed in Misha Business's records in the past. Is that fair?
Yes.
And are you aware of any of those symptoms that were reported absent the context of methamphetamine use?
No, I am not.
And so like concepts like, you know, psychosis or meth-induced psychosis, I think you mentioned, those are as a result of methamphetamine use.
Yes. My review of the record indicates that all of the psychosis observed objectively occurred in the context of methamphetamine use.
And then finally, you were asked some questions about the MMPI. I think there was a question about like lack of education and if that can impact that. Is that you remember that question?
Yes.
All right. Is there any information you're aware of any cognitive deficit for the defendant?
No. My understanding was that she attributed her learning difficulties to ADHD. She did not have an individual education program or IEP that would signify learning deficits, and she has a high school diploma, which indicates she had sufficient reading level to take the MMPI-3.
Thank you, Doctor. Nothing further.
Anything on those topics, Mr. Freilich?
Did she say that she had concentration issues?
I don't recall that.
When you talked to her, she was very quiet, correct?
She was soft-spoken.
Didn't give a lot of information, correct?
I disagree with that. I obtained a reasonable history from her.
Okay. It wasn't like she gave one-word answers?
No.
But the responses were short. Is that fair?
No.
Okay. Nothing further.
Anything on that?
No.
Thank you, Dr. You can step away.
Thank you.
Any other witnesses from the state?
No, Your Honor, the state rests.
Any rebuttal testimony, Mr. Frelick?
No.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the evidentiary portion of this case is now closed. So to give you a sense of what's next, it's similar to the process that you've already experienced, and that is I'm going to instruct you as to the rules and the law that you need to apply. The attorneys will make their closing arguments, and then you'll deliberate. I need a few minutes to work with the attorneys. The instructions are much shorter this time, so I won't need as much time to work with them on it. But I do need a few minutes to finish those up, so I'm going to excuse you at this time. All rise for the jury. I want to address some of the issues that you raised before when we were talking about the instruction. I don't have a problem delivering the instructions before you do closing arguments, and so I would probably take 160 and move it. And I want to just indicate the reason that I had proposed that is for this reason. When I look at 605, the last two paragraphs in 605 seem very similar to 515, which is read after the closing arguments, before the jury goes out. And so I was looking for something as a way to kind of conclude the matter, as opposed to the last argument is made and I just say, go. So my suggestion is, if I read the instructions in the order that you've proposed, other than moving 160 to after 605, other than that, I'm proposing that I give a modified 460 just before the jurors leave. So after closings, I give a modified 460. 460 is the instruction, and I'm having my judicial assistant draft that up. That's the one that says something as follows, and I know you gentlemen have heard it before. Now, members of the jury, the duties of counsel in the court have been performed. The case has been argued by counsel. It's that instruction. And the only thing I would eliminate is the second paragraph of that instruction, which says, you are to decide only whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty of the offenses charged. Any consequences of your verdict are matters for the court alone to decide and must not affect your deliberations. I delete that paragraph because, first of all, this isn't a question of guilt or innocence at this phase, and secondly, because they're actually informed about the consequences of their action when I read 605. So I think that paragraph should come out. But in exchange for giving the instructions before you close, my suggestion is give that modified 460 after your closings. I then swear the bailiffs and send the jury out. Any objection to that, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Frelick?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I gave you the proposed verdict forms, and what I noticed as I was looking at them, There were spots for the dissenting jurors to sign, but there was no spot for the foreperson. My judicial assistant is making that change. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go make these revisions and then bring them back to you. But there are a couple of other things I need to call to your attention. First of all, a change that I made in 100, the opening instruction, is in the third paragraph. You should have that. I put it in bold, that if any member of the jury has an impression of my opinion as to the issues in this phase, disregard that impression. That would take the place of the language that's given in the first phase, which is, if any member of the jury has an impression of my opinion as to whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. So I switched that. Any objection, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Frelick?
No.
Okay. Mr. Frelick, I need to speak with you, and perhaps you need to speak with your client about whether you want me to give 315. That's the instruction that your client, during the first phase, elected that I give. That's the instruction that says a defendant in a criminal case has the absolute constitutional right not to testify. And that's really, she has an option to have me give that or not give it.
Talk to my client. We both agree that you could read 315.
You're asking that I give that?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Business, you've had an opportunity to speak with your attorney about that decision?
Yes.
Okay. And I know you spoke with him about it at the beginning of the first phase. You'd like me to give that instruction in this phase?
Yes.
All right. I'll give 315. 640, mental disease or defect expert opinion testimony. The interesting piece there is that the last paragraph, the court has appointed, and then it says to fill in the name. Two of the people that were appointed by this court testified, only one on the NGI piece, but two of them testified, and they both testified they were court appointed. And it indicates that you shouldn't give the weight, give their testimony any greater weight. I think probably both of their names should be in there, but I could see an argument that only Dr. Engen's name should be on there because she was appointed on the NGI. On the other hand, they were both appointed by the court, and the notion that they shouldn't be given any greater weight than anybody else seems to apply to both of them. Mr. Saunders, any opinion on that?
Not really. I guess the preference would be to include both.
Mr. Frelick?
It would be my position that we would only use Dr. Christina Engen because she's the one that did the NGI evaluation.
Okay. I'll just give Dr. Engen's. We keep pronouncing her name differently. I've heard it pronounced both ways. Is it Engen, like an engine, or is it Engen? I thought I heard her say Engen.
It's the latter.
Engen, I think.
That's how I'm going to pronounce it. Moving on then to 605, there are some options that we need to address. And that is under the subheading meaning of mental disease or defect. I have some thoughts about which ones seem appropriate given the evidence, but let's just run through them. The first option is, because it indicates that in that particular portion, add the following if supported by the evidence. First, temporary passion or frenzy prompted by revenge, hatred, jealousy, envy. That just doesn't seem to apply. I don't think it should be inserted. Agree with that, Mr. Saunders?
Yes.
Mr. Frelick?
Yes, I do.
That'll be out. The next one, an abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct does not constitute a mental disease or defect. Mr. Saunders?
I think that should be included. Particularly there was testimony about the criminal conduct, but antisocial, I think that kind of fits into a lot of the jail conduct reports, other behavioral things that the defense has raised.
Mr. Frelick?
I disagree. I didn't hear anybody, any doctor or professional say anything about antisocial conduct. So I would object to that.
I'm going to give that instruction for this reason. There was a lot of testimony about conduct that the average person could characterize as antisocial. And I think that's an important piece of information for them to have. So I'm going to keep that in. I note Mr. Frelick's objection, but that's going to be the order of the court. The next one, voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol or both does not constitute a mental disease or defect. I note that the parties stipulated at the last phase that should come in. I'm assuming that's where we're at now. But Mr. Saunders, you're asking for that?
Yes.
Mr. Frelick?
I'll agree.
Okay. The next one is a temporary mental state which is brought into existence by the voluntary taking of drugs or alcohol does not constitute a mental disease or defect. Mr. Saunders, you're asking for that?
Yes.
Any objection, Mr. Frelick?
Yes, I would argue that it's duplicitous. It's, you know, it's doubling up. The paragraph before is, I think, says enough. It's mentioning it twice, basically.
So, well, I think the difference is voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol or both does not constitute a mental disease or defect. The other one is a temporary mental state. The other one referenced temporary mental state versus voluntary intoxication. temporary mental state, which is brought into existence by the voluntary taking. And I think that's consistent with some of the testimony that has been offered here. So I understand the argument, Mr. Frelick. I'm going to include that option. I think it's appropriate in light of the evidence that's come into this case.
Your Honor?
Yes.
One more argument, and I respect the court's ruling, but just to make sure I'm doing my part, is that just saying it a different way? I would make that argument, too.
Well, a voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol does not constitute a mental disease or defect.
I was just saying it a different way, in my opinion, my humble opinion.
Mr. Saunders, any response to that?
Yes, I think they're pretty clearly different. A voluntary induced state of intoxication refers to using methamphetamine, using alcohol, using some other illicit substance. A temporary mental state brought into existence, I think, refers to the circumstances that Dr. Engen testified to about meth-induced psychosis or symptoms that are brought about by use of substances, because that speaks to the mental state. Induced is basically the same thing as which is brought into existence. So I think they're different.
Okay. I think the difference, Mr. Frelick, in response to your objection, is for someone to be in a voluntary induced state of intoxication, the jury couldn't find that that's a mental disease or defect. The next option is if a mental state exists, if there is a potentially a diagnosable mental state that exists on a temporary basis. So not just the intoxication, the mental state, which was brought into existence by the use of drugs, that does not constitute a mental disease or defect. I think they're different, so I note your objections and your amendment to your objections, but I'm going to give both of those because I think they're different.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The next, then, is chronic use of drugs or alcohol may produce a condition that can constitute a mental disease or defect if the condition has become permanent. Mr. Saunders?
I don't think this one should be given. We didn't hear testimony about the latter part of that, that there is some permanent, and we talked about this with Dr. O'Donnell, that there is some permanent condition that the defendant has. So I don't think it's an appropriate instruction to include.
Mr. Frelick?
I strongly disagree with the state on this. I think this language should come in. The court should consider it. I asked, I believe, Dr. Engen and Dr. Seipel, and I believe Dr. Layton, that, you know, using drugs over time can cause brain damage. And so I'd ask that you allow that as part of the jury instruction, Your Honor.
Anything else?
Well, yes, it can, but there's been no evidence that if the condition has become permanent, that is something the defendant's afflicted by. So I don't think it's proper to instruct the jury on something that can be out there if there's no evidence that this actually is in existence. I think it invites speculation. I think it kind of is confusing to some extent as well. If counsel wanted to have an expert to testify about a permanent condition the defendant has, they could have done that.
Your Honor?
Yes.
It's crystal clear to me that this should absolutely come in. This young lady, Taylor Denise Chabizas, was under a court order for involuntary medication and an order for civil commitment, which it doesn't happen very often. She was found by a court of law, by Judge Lee Joyce, to be mentally ill. And she was at the Nicolet Psychiatric Center for approximately a few weeks, where she was receiving injectable Abilify antipsychotic. She was getting treatment, and it was clear, the records replete with the fact that she had a chronic problem with meth, methamphetamine, marijuana. So I think it's totally on point, and that should be something that the court should consider. The operative word, in my humble opinion, is can. That word can, I think that makes it such that it would be applicable in this particular case.
I think the focus is if the condition has become permanent and whether that's supported by the evidence. There's no doubt that chronic use of drugs or alcohol has come into this case. Satisfied in light of the state of the record that it ultimately comes down to what the jurors heard. There has been a great deal of testimony regarding the use of drugs or alcohol. There were some questions placed to the defense expert about impacts on. On a person long-term using various drugs. Satisfied, the jury can assess that. I'm going to give that instruction. Certainly the parties can argue that they don't believe the evidence supports that particular aspect, but I'm going to give that piece. So I'm going to include that. And then that's the last option that has to be selected. I'm going to make these revisions then, and then I will give you a final copy of them. And then we will move, we'll bring the jury back in and we'll move to instructions and closings. All right, we are in recess.
Thank you.
You're listening to True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast continuous coverage of the trial of Taylor Shabusiness, Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage.
More raw trial audio next.